everybody, and as they say, you know, the best is often kept till near the end, and I think you're all in for a fantastic treat, and we're very, can you not hear me? We're very honoured here at the Hay Festival in Cartagena that Yung Chang has, and John Halliday, her husband, have come all this way to talk to us this afternoon. Yung is an extraordinary woman who I've had the privilege to know for a number of years. She, her writing career began with her wonderful autobiography, Wild Swans, and she followed it up with this astonishing book about Ma, which is what we're going to talk about today. Together, the books have sold over 15 million copies worldwide, which is some feat for any writer to be able to say that they've had two books that have done that. The book that we're talking about today, Ma, is a book that she wrote with her husband, John, who is a historian and a writer, and I would say an academic, but he says he doesn't want to be described as an academic, but I think he is as well. He says that makes him sound boring, which he is absolutely not. And so we're going to also talk about the process of writers working in collaboration as we go through the tale. But where I want to begin, I mean, what interests me is not so much the, as we were talking about before, the sort of the whole analytical situation, but the question of Mao the man, and that is what this book does so extraordinarily, is tell you in acute detail about the life of this person who was a colossus of the last century and who dominated vast numbers of people, who changed people's lives and who did extraordinary things and was seen in very many different lights, both in South America, in Europe, and of course in China. So when you finished Wild Swans, Yung, what made you go on then to take on this gigantic challenge, which took you both 10 years, didn't it, I think?
12 years.
Sorry, 12 right, years. My first mistake.
Well, when Wild Swans was published in the early 1990s, by the way, Wild Swans is a story about my grandmother, my mother, and myself, about our lives in the 20th century. And a large part of the book is about life under Mao. Mm. So when the book was published, Mao seemed to be the obvious subject for me to write about. And I wanted to write about him because I felt that, you know, he dominated my early life, and I saw him turning the lives of a quarter of the world's population upside down. And yet I felt the world knew astonishingly little about him. And the Chinese themselves knew little about him. And I myself knew quite little about him. So I wanted to find out a bit more. And John was also interested in Mao. So we decided to do this together.
So how did you begin your research into this very mysterious but enormous figure who everyone in the world had heard of but who knew so little about?
Didn't I mean she just say one? She just one the fit before John starts. Well, the thing is, we divided our research by language, and because I'm Chinese, so I dealt with the Chinese language sources. And John, unfortunately, speaks many languages, so he was landed with the rest of the world. And in particular, he knows Russian, and he spent many years working in the Russian archives.
Well, we sat down, and well, as regards myself, I made some notes about what, you know, what's the official version of Mao, which is the version he himself created and which is still maintained by the regime in China and to a large extent was swallowed by much of the rest of the world. And then I started making a list of questions which were, what do we not know about Mao and why don't we know it? And then the next question was, where might the answer to this question be? And for my own part, the fact is, I mean, 95% of what I put in the book came from the Russian archives. And we were very lucky because they had just opened after the fall of communism. And there was, one file they opened as I got there on the history of relationship between Moscow and the Chinese Communist Party had about 250,000 pages in it, documenting a number of major, the whole of Mao's relationship really with Moscow over more than 20 years, and which allowed us to cast his rise to power and some episodes like the Long March, which we've come back to, in a completely different light. So in that way, we were very, very lucky. And it also turned out there was much more around than people had thought. There were even things in London sitting there. For example, communications between the Russians and the Chinese Communist Party just before the Long March, which the British had intercepted in 1934. And amongst these was a very important one, showing that Mao's colleagues couldn't stand him and had tried to leave him behind, get rid of him before the Long March, and asked the Russians to take him to Moscow to get him off their hands. And the Russians sent a cable back saying, you can't get rid of Mao just like that. And the subtext, of course, is because he's Stalin's man. But that was actually sitting, to my astonishment, sitting in London. So we had tremendous fun trying to find out where information would be. And then Jung, of course, did a miraculous job in China tracking down all these people who worked with Mao and knew a lot of secrets and were very helpful.
But the Long March is one of the great myths of Mao, isn't it? I mean, and one of the things that, you know, people thought this was a great heroic thing and that he did. That did you grow up yourself with the myth of it? I mean, explain how the Long March was seen within China.
Right. Well, I grew up, yes, thinking this Long March was this heroic episode when the communists moved from southeast China to the northwest to fight Japan. And to fight Japan was one myth, because they weren't going there to fight Japan. They were actually going there to receive Russian arms. That's one myth we kind of found, the truth of which we found out during the research. But one thing that shocked me very much was I always thought that Mao traveled like ordinary soldiers on foot. I mean, this was the propaganda. We were all told, you know, how heroic Chairman Mao was. You know, he was walking like an average soldier. But then we discovered that wasn't true at all. He was carried most of the way on this litter, bamboo litter, which was like a bed. And he actually had designed this form of transportation for himself, so he could lie back. And there was a warning, and he would be shielded from the sun and the rain. And actually, he said in later life to his staff, he said, during the Long March, I had nothing to do. I was lying in the litter. And what did I do? I read a lot, because Mao was a tremendous book lover, and he did read a lot. That's another story I come back to.
But already from that long ago, from the Long March, he had this extraordinary power over people. How did he do it? What was the essence of the man that enabled him to get carried on the Long March, and yet the rest of the world thinks he traipsed along with his men?
Well, the version that he traipsed along with his men was designed, concocted by himself after the Long March, and it was the story he and his colleagues organized very carefully to tell to somebody called Edgar Snow, an American journalist who wrote a book called Red Star Over China, which became more or less the vehicle that conveyed this myth. But the core question of how Mao got to the top, let's say,
people must have been very frightened of him.
They were. They were.
Go along with this.
They were. And they were frightened of him. And another factor, which didn't, I think, it wasn't really clear until we did this research, is that by this point, his colleagues knew that he was Stalin's man, and they depended on the Russians for survival. And in fact, before the Long March, on two occasions, particularly on 1932, Mao's seven, there were eight people in the core leadership, They voted 7-1 to get rid of Mao. And they didn't like him. They didn't trust him. He was a nightmare to work with. But when they passed this decision, the orders came back from Moscow saying, you can't do that to Mao. You have to keep. So they already knew that he was Stalin's man, and that if they dumped him, they wanted to dump him, but if they did so, they would lose the benefits, you know, financial, etc., from the Russians. But he did also have tremendous personal qualities, and they're very like Stalin's qualities, which they're not the qualities of a democratic politician who goes out and makes a speech about building schools and hospitals. They're the guy who's really, really good in a small room, manipulating people, dividing people from each other. And he was a tremendous judge of character. He was very, very good at spotting people who had the qualities he didn't have, and also spotting weaknesses. And he was a terrific blackmailer. And he was the sort of guy, the last point is, I think, he was the sort of guy who by now, by the time of the Long March, made you feel, if I cross Mao, he's going to come and get me.
Explain more, though, about the relationship between him and Stalin and China's dependency. Because, I mean, of the many things that when I read the book, I thought, gosh, I knew nothing about this. This was so extraordinary, the relationship and the way that his child was sent to Moscow. And tell us more about that, because it's very...
Well, the Chinese Communist Party was set up by the Russians, by Russian emissaries in the beginning of the 1920s. And what we didn't have before, we had hints, but we didn't have this huge mass of cables on an almost everyday basis between the Russians and the Chinese Communists saying, do this, do that. And in the fighting against the nationalists, who were the government in the period before the Long March, the Russians, who had agents in all the cities down the coast and right into the hinterland of China, were giving the Chinese Communists instructions, you know, about even individual units in the Nationalist Army, saying this one might disintegrate, you know, this one has got a weakness. The Russian guys stole the codes of some of the Nationalist units, some very important codes. And they also were giving instructions on political issues. And one of the most important things in the Russian archives is Mao launched a huge purge of other communists in 1930, very early on. And it was a horrific purge. And it's three guys who'd been purged and tortured anyway, managed to break away, get to Shanghai, where the Russians had their underground headquarters. And even one of them even took his shirt off and showed all these scars on his back and so on. At any rate, this news went to Moscow, and the Russians just said, forget these guys. Mao is our man. Don't listen to these dissidents who've been tortured. It doesn't, you know. And so on all these really everyday issues, the orders were coming, instructions were coming from Russia. And later on... Mao was the only foreign communist leader in the world that Stalin kept up a personal correspondence with. Stalin even tolerated a certain degree of independence. I mean, Mao was not a slave, but he knew that his political future was tied to that of Stalin. And in fact, and the last point is he in 1923, he said something very, very... Mao had foresight. He had terrific political foresight. And in 1923, he saw that communism wasn't going anywhere in China. There were about 100 or 200 members of the party. And he made a speech to this little group saying, communism just isn't working. It hasn't got a hope in hell. The only way it's ever going to work is if the Russians invade China and bring it in with the Red Soviet Red Army. And that is, in fact, exactly, this is the big, I think, had been the big missing link in the history of how communism took over China, was that in 1945, the Russians did invade China under the pretext of entering the war against Japan. They occupied an area larger than the whole of Central and Eastern Europe that they occupied. And it was that military presence through which they were able to arm and train what was a very ragtag Chinese communist force and bring them to power by military means. And the proof of that is that there wasn't a single uprising in any town or city in the whole of China during the entire civil war. It was completely military victory.
And then, of course, Mao was prepared to trade food, anything, to get arms and the things he felt he needed from Stalin, with a ruthless...
This one keeps falling down. That he was prepared to trade, you know, to just give away the crown jewels as such, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, after Mao took power, his next goal was to turn China into a military superpower so he could conquer the world. I mean, this, I must say, this discovery just took me by surprise, because we all thought Mao was messing about the Chinese, but he wasn't interested in the world. Far from it. I mean, to dominate the world was Mao's single-minded pursuit since he took power in 1949. And how did he go about achieving this goal? Mao bought huge quantities of arms industries, particularly nuclear technology and equipment to build atom bombs, hydrogen bombs, missiles, and so on. And how was he going to pay for all these very expensive purchases? And Mao's answer was to export food. So he exported food which he knew his people were dependent on for survival to Russia and some to Eastern Europe to buy these hugely expensive military industries. And as a result, nearly 40 million people died of starvation and overwork between 1958 and 1961. I mean, even Mao's number two thought this was too extreme and tried to ask Mao to stop. And Mao wouldn't. And he said things like, you know, having only tree leaves to eat, so what? You know, educate the peasant to eat less. And death have benefit. They can fertilize the land. So in many parts of China, when peasants died, they were not allowed to build tombs and were just buried in the farmland, and the crops were planted on top. And Mao even said for all his projects to take off, half of China may well have to die. I must say, I was really shocked.
How did you discover that? What was your process of research to get? Because you were the first person to write this, weren't you?
Right. I mean, we knew about the famine. I think a lot of people here probably all knew about the famine. Yes. And I thought the famine was the result of economic mismanagement. But then we found, or John found, you know, these documents from the Russian sources, which showed China's food export to Russia. And then from the Chinese sources, we knew that Mao knew about these huge quantities of food export, and there were explicit instructions saying things like leaving the basic, you know, food for people, for the urban basic urban people to survive, but don't leave any tea. Teas for export, fruits for export, eggs for export, you know, pork, which was the Chinese main source of meat for export. I mean, these are all documented. And then we calculated that if China didn't export these foods, not a single Chinese had to die. And Mao, the fact is, Mao knew about this. We also had documents of this internal debate among the Chinese leaders. I mean, with Mao's colleagues, most of Mao's colleagues saying this is, you know, too extreme. And with Mao saying, basically, as I just said, you know, for all his projects to take off half of China may well have to die. He was prepared for that.
That sort of goes back to our original question. I mean, How did he do it? How did he, I mean, this is such a staggering numbers of people who he was prepared to sacrifice. How did he get away with it? I mean, what was his treatment of his colleagues in terms of
how he made them so frightened, how he destabilized people, scared people, that they allowed this to go on?
He was able to carry through his wishes because he was the boss, you know, he was the person to give orders. His Politburo was not an organization to discuss and make decisions. They were like Mao's think tanks. They provided arguments or provided, sort of give their thoughts to Mao. But Mao was always the one to make a decision. And it was impossible to think of toppling Mao in those days because Mao had perfected his personal security and the whole system to secure his own security way back from 1927 when he first became the boss. So through the decades, he's built up an unbreakable security system.
What sort of things did he do? I mean, you write fascinatingly about the strange houses and the moving around and the kind of people not knowing where he was and...
Yes, okay, I'll just quickly finish how, actually, in the end, Mao didn't quite have his way completely, because after 4 years of famine, his number two, President Liu Shaoqi, then kind of pulled a fast one, outsmarted Mao at a party congress for 7,000 party officials, and by what Mao described as a surprise attack. They did stop Mao's policies that was going to generate more death. And Mao was furious. He wanted revenge. And this was why he launched the Cultural Revolution 4 years later. And he then made all his opponents to pay. And the President Liu, Mao's number two, died a horrible death, and Mao had, Liu's last days, days of agony, filmed and photographed, and took pleasure watching those. So about Mao's security measures, John has some more, but the Mao's houses, we visited Mao's dozens of houses all over China, and Mao at least had 53 villas dotted around China. I mean, they were usually in spectacular, beautiful places where there had been some elegant houses. And Mao had all these houses pulled down and built his personal bunker-like house. And they were all bulletproof, bomb-proof, some even atom bomb-proof. And the windows were staggered. I mean, so from the outside, you could never see inside. And Mao had special railway lines built from his villas to the local military airport so he could make a quick getaway if there was some trouble. And frequently, he stayed in his bulletproof train parked at a military airport. So he could make a quick getaway if there was any trouble.
Extraordinary. And his treatment of his family was also very weird and brutal, wasn't it, as well? The treatment of his wives.
Yes. Well, just to wrap up what I just said, in his 27 years in power, in his own country, which he ruled, Mao lived like... as he were in a war zone. Now, this was also something that surprised me, that how Mao treated his wives. Because, even some dictators, some tyrants have soft corners for their own family. But Mao was really heartless to an incredible degree. He was married four times. His number two wife, according to him, was the love of his life. But as we discovered, Mao had actually abandoned her together with their three young sons, the youngest only 4 months old. This was from some manuscripts she wrote before she died, diaries, letters, poems. I mean, she wrote those and she hid those in the house. I mean, they were there for decades until the 1980s and 1990s, and they were discovered. And Mao's third wife bore him many children, and most of them were given away or died in infancy. And Mao was completely indifferent. During the Long March in 1935, this third wife gave birth to a baby girl, and the baby girl was immediately given to a local family who had no milk, and the baby girl soon died. The third wife then went on the Long March, and a few weeks later, she was hit by a bomb and nearly died. In both cases, her death, her near death and her giving birth to a baby girl, Mao was in the same town. But he didn't even go and visit her. He was said to be too tired. So not surprisingly, the third wife suffered a mental breakdown and was in and out of insanity until her last days. And Mao's fourth wife was this Madam Mao, notorious Madam Mao, Jiang Qing, who many people still blame for the horrors of the Cultural Revolution. But as we discovered, actually, Jiang Qing generated no policies. I mean, it was really Mao who used her. Mao knew she was a vicious woman. And Mao once said to a family member, Jiang Qing is like a scorpion. She's full of venom, and Mao wriggled his little finger to imitate a scorpion. So Mao then used her to do all the dirty work other people wouldn't do, and he knew everybody hated her. In the last couple of years of his life, Mao was suffering from this incurable disease, and he was terrified of a coup against himself. So Mao said to his military commanders, you are welcome to do in my wife and her gang as long as you leave me to die in my bed. Then this was exactly what happened. You know, Mao died in his bed in 1976. Less than a month later, Madam Mao and the rest of the gang of four were arrested. And later, Madam Mao committed suicide in prison.
Do you believe she committed suicide, or was she murdered?
She committed suicide. This was many years later. Now, she was suffering from a throat cancer, which was very painful. And she had nothing to live for. She also had, she was a horrible woman, but she also had a terrible life.
Yeah, terrible. John, one of the things that I found very interesting in the book was, again, something I didn't know at all about him, was Mao's attempts, and you've touched on it, as wanting to have world domination. And that, again, in the same way that he was prepared to sacrifice his people in order to try to get rather second-rate arms, in fact, from Stalin, he was also trying to be Mr. Generous in terms of being seen as Mr. Bountiful, who would invest in Albania or other communist regimes around the world.
Yes.
How much of the country's capital did he sort of give away in that way to try to be seen as a statesman, a world player?
Well, in terms of capital, he didn't. China didn't hardly invest it in foreign countries in that sort of way. Although it did a bit in Pakistan and would give hospitals to Cambodia. It would build stadiums for countries it wanted to be friends with. And of course, it did things like it threw in a very large number of troops into the Korean War, which was also part of a calculation to get things from Stalin. And he, the Vietnamese, I think the sort of estimated total of what they either gave or put into the Vietnam War is usually given as a figure of about $20 billion, although it's hard to be absolute. But what has emerged, which we have in the book, Chiong found, is that during the Cultural Revolution, when Mao was, it was around the time he got into the UN and he patched up things with America, he was, in order to buy influence, China, I mean, you know that the moment there's attempt to try and raise the level of foreign aid from rich countries, I think, to about 1% of, is it GNP or GDP? Mao was, at the peak, was almost 7% of China's, I think it's GDP, it's state expenditure. But it's an astronomical figure, which is far higher than any other country in the world, and this is for very poor country. And in specific cases that we know, we went to Albania and we worked in the Albanian archives, which was a very interesting experience. And actually, one of the first things we found in there was Mao's secret police chief Kang Sheng in Albania complaining to the Albanians that they were letting a lot of people run off with this money. In fact, there were some Venezuelans, in particular, I remember in the first file we saw, Kang Sheng was getting absolutely furious about this vast sum of money, which some con man, some left wing con man, I think, had just decided to realize that if you just buttered up the Chinese, all you had to do was write a poem about Mao Zedong or something like that, and you could walk off with a whole lot of money. But the other thing they did was, in order to win friends in Albania, for example, they gave the Albanians so much aid that Albania was able to lift rationing at a time when in China, you know, people were literally starving, and the same for the whole of East Germany. They would do so. Mao was prepared to, I mean, and did not just sacrifice the sort of well-being of his own people, but actually, you know, prepared to drive them to the level of stuff. In order, it didn't really increase the security of China. It was for his own glorification.
Maybe. Did it make him seem bigger in the eyes of his colleagues that he had these world friends?
Well, I think his colleagues knew very well that all this influence was bought. But Mao felt quite good. I mean, you know, after he dispensed the food and the other aid, for example, to the East Germans. By the way, it was thanks to Chinese food that East Germany was able to lift its food ration in 1957, I mean, when Mao's people were starving. I mean, Mao then was giving, tried to give orders to like the East Germans and to other people. And to the East Germans, actually, he suggested the building the wall, building a wall. He said, why don't you build a wall like we built the Great Wall of China? And a few years later, Berlin Wall indeed came up. I don't know whether there was any link in this, but he, you know, he was acting. You could see from his from the sort of records of his meeting these statesmen, and he was acting as their mentor, and very much like how Stalin acted to the world communist leaders.
But some communist leaders, I mean, you were mentioning earlier that Castro, from very early on, took a terrific dislike to Mao. I mean, even when we in the West were kind of still thinking that, sort of a radical left was thinking that Mao was a okay thing, Castro was ahead of the game there.
Yes, well, Castro had a particular reason, I think, for loathing Mao, which was about the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway, Mao tried to manipulate the Cuban Missile Crisis, the fallout from the crisis. And
what did he want to achieve from that?
That's a very good question. I think he probably did want Castro to press the button if he could, you know. I mean, because there isn't much, but he wanted, the other thing is he wanted to win Castro over to his side in the dispute between himself, Mao, and the Russians. It was the time of the Sino-Soviet split, and Mao was going all out to win friends and allies. And I think his thinking was, these Cubans are radicals like us, you know, they shouldn't be going along with these soppy bureaucrats in Moscow who are just going to sell them out and so on. And they ought to be with us, and I'm annoyed that they're not. So, for example, the first time Che Guevara went to China, Mao greeted him like a terrific old friend and even published a bit of Che Guevara's writings in China, which was almost unheard of. And the second time Che Guevara went back after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Mao wouldn't even see him. And then when actually when Guevara was in Bolivia, they tried to get the Chinese to help with a radio station. Chinese just said, get lost. And it's quite interesting in the conversations between Kissinger and the Chinese leaders mm-hmm. that have come out recently, the two people that the Chinese and Kissinger really spend most time slagging off are the Indians and Che Guevara. But Castro, the Chinese also did the dirty on him about supplying food to Cuba after the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so Castro, at one point, if I may use this expression,
yes,
may I say?
I think it's fine.
He said to, I think it was to Feltrinelli, the Italian publisher, he said, Mao is a shit. I think it was probably the feelings were more or less mutual. But just back one second to the cult of personality. Sorry, because on the way here, I was reading the memoirs of Pablo Neruda. Yeah. And although he was a bit, as we all know, he wasn't always as alert as he might have been about what was going on in the communist countries. But to give him his due, he went to China in 1951 and then back in 1957. And the thing that really, he said, I can't take this any longer. I can't take this, what he called Mao Estalinismo in Spanish. And the thing that he writes that really turned him off was not the suffering and the repression and everything in China, but the cult of Mao, which he said, this thing of turning the leader into a god. But of course, that was probably what he saw. He wouldn't have seen the level of repression and suffering. So he could see the cult, and at least to give him his due, he said, I've had it. That's it.
And also, I think with the Cuban thing, as with a lot of other sort of third world countries, and Mao saw himself as the world's leader for guerrilla wars. Mm-hmm. And so he thought that there was a Cuban revolution, which is kind of like a guerrilla war. And he very much wanted to be a teacher figure for Castro, which Castro didn't want to have. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why they didn't get on. I exchanged words like that. When Castro said Mao was a pile of shit, Mao then said Castro was a jackal under sheepskin. And anyway, then when the Che Guevara died, Mao's intelligence chief said to the Albanians, now in Latin America, the situation is really good. Now it's looking up. Now that Che Guevara is dead.
I can see time marching on here. I'm sorry, there's always so much to talk to you about this. But when your book came out in 2005, I mean, it must have been an absolute bombshell when the news of what you had written about started to drift through China. I know the book is banned, but copies have got in, haven't they? You have done a translation. What has been the reception from different levels of the Chinese government to the portrait you have painted?
Yes. Well,
difficult question, long right. question, I'm sorry.
Well, of course, a bit of background is that Mao's portrait is still hanging on Tiananmen Gate in the center of the Chinese capital. His corpse is still lying in Tiananmen Square for people to worship. His face is on every Chinese banknote, and he is still taught in the schools and in the Chinese media as this great man who made mistakes.
When they say mistakes, what, I mean, a mistake to kill 37 million people?
Well, the thing is, the Chinese regime has got an official line, which is to keep history vague. So you don't ask questions. You know, people are not allowed to ask questions. And now, when our book was published, and when we have calculated that Mao was responsible for the death of at least 70 million Chinese in peacetime, and together with all our discoveries in the Russian archives mm-hmm. from all these sources. And it was a huge, it made a huge impact in China. It was like a huge bombshell. And so I think for a while, the I mean, Well, even today, I mean, many people are asking for a reevaluation of Mao or for the party to change its name to, you know, to kind of to turn its back definitively on Mao. And for in the last few years, I think the Chinese leadership has been debating over this issue. And I think now they've come to the conclusion now this is not something they're going to do. And in the very recent party congress, they explicitly rejected what they call to change the banner of the path of changing our banner, meaning, you know, to reject Mao, this which is the Chinese way of saying.
Is that out of fear or a sense of collective guilt that you don't want to say what has happened? I mean, it's all now quite a long time ago. Where does that drive come from, that you're not prepared to face the truth and sort of say, this is what happened, and move on into a new kind of world? Why is the hold still so strong?
Well, to start with, I mean, the Communist Party is still called the Communist Party, mm-hmm. and it has no intention of changing its name, which means, you know, to reject its legacy. And it still claims legitimacy from Mao. And now it's sort of even more, in a way, more difficult to reject Mao than when in the years after Mao's death. Because in these 30 years since Mao died, more than 30 years, I mean, China has carried on with this brainwashing. And Mao has been built up as this mythical figure.
So how is he taught in schools when you're 6 years old?
Mao is this great leader who has made sure that China has stood up, you know, this expression.
And how is that surviving in a world that we live in now? I mean, I know you have censorship of the internet still in China, but information is getting in there. How is that myth being preserved?
Well, the internet is under ferocious control in China. I mean, you know, for example, both our names would be barred. I mean, if you try to search, for example, my name, you get a page saying you have made a mistake, saying the user. And, you know, if you try to search our Mao biography, again, you get, you get a page saying, you know, you it doesn't exist. Before they clamped down in the last couple of years, and there was a time when there were hundreds of thousands of blogs and comments on our book, which was fantastic. And then when the party made its decision and it wiped out everything, I saw this because I saw these hundreds of thousands. I was very excited. I was reading those. And then in a couple of weeks' time, they're all gone. I mean, one was deleted in front of my eyes because I'm of course, people kept putting their comments onto the internet. And I was reading one when suddenly the page, that these words appeared. This particular column is under review. Wait a minute. I mean, then the next sheet came over and said, this item has been censored. I mean, they would use these words, has been censored. So the censorship is there. It's very, very difficult to get information from outside China.
And when you yourself went back in November, and did you go too, John, at that point? I mean, what kind of reception did you get?
Well, my mother still lives in China, so I go there to see her and my friends. I got the most fantastic welcome from, you know, the people who have read the book. I mean, mostly have read the pirated editions or internet, because a lot of people have scanned, before the clampdown, had scanned our book into the computer for other people to download. Then, you know, people are absolutely wonderful, but I'm also going under strict restrictions, which is not to talk in public, and not to accept interviews from Chinese press. The Chinese press is under tighter control than literally 100 years ago.
So all the ideas of let's have the Olympics and let's have a free and open China are rubbish?
Well, people do have a lot of personal freedom, you know, traveling, whatever. I'm including complaints would not appear in the Chinese press, but they can appear in the Chinese internet website. So there are these small progress, because we are dealing with the area which is going to change last. We happen to be in this area. So in this area, there is no freedom. There is no openness.
And well, before we throw it open to the audience, I mean, one last question. How do you see it ever changing? I mean, how do you see it? Do you see a day coming when a real picture of Mao and what he really did will emerge in China and be taught openly in schools and colleges and discussed, and that Jung will be welcomed there to lecture and to be able to speak to people like she's able to speak to all of us here tonight?
Well, not until the Chinese Communist Party gives...
But they're kind of capitalists. I mean, they can't.
Well, they are a Communist Party. They still are. And just to add to what Jung said, I mean, Mao, the so-called Maoism or Mao Zedong thought, is written into the state constitution. So this is a very important factor just about how he's perceived or represented in China, because it's a criminal offense. It's a criminal offense to query Mao, and it's a criminal offense to challenge the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on power and even its claim to have a monopoly on power. So it's very tight communist in that way and on the media. But I don't think... I mean, the question earlier, the very interesting discussion about, you know, why won't they, in some ways they are a very modern state, why won't they just accept, they're not, most of their policies now are not Maoist. I mean, it's a completely different country. I think, it just to add to what was said, is that, well, first of all, I think they say to themselves, what's in it for me? What's in it for denouncing Mao? And then to balance the pluses and the minuses. And if we compare it with the only previous or the main historical reference point, I suppose, would be Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin in 1956. But that, if you go back and read it, you will see it's only a denunciation of how Stalin treated members of the Communist Party. It's not a denunciation of communism itself, and least of all, it's far from being a denunciation of Lenin and Leninism. It's a tremendous... The real point is, let's keep Leninism by discarding bits of what Stalin did. And the Chinese can't do that because Mao is, of course, both Stalin and Lenin. And the other thing is, if they had a real honest review about Mao... One, I think the biggest sticking point would be who really fought the Japanese during the Pacific War. Because at the moment, the main point on which the Chinese communists pretend to their own people that they have a right to rule is not the vote, of course, because there isn't one, nor is it actually the Civil War most of the time. It's a vague claim that we, the communists, are the ones who really... fought the Japanese and protected you Chinese people from the Japanese. Now, this claim is completely false, as we show in our book, but that's one they absolutely don't want to get into and would be in a lot of trouble if that stuff... A lot of trouble in terms of their own claim to legitimacy. So I'm afraid I don't think this wonderful day will come until the Chinese Communist Party gives up its monopoly of power, and at a guess, I would say they've got another 20, 25 years to go.
Fascinating. Well, thank you. So we've got about another 10 or 15 minutes left, so please, two microphones out here in the audience, and
two microphones that are out. Sorry about this. It's me that you can hear. Are roaming around. So a hand right here in the front. I'll take the gentleman there first.
Hello.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. You need to put your...
Oh, right. Sir.
Okay.
Yo no he avanzado mucho en la lectura de su libro, pero hay unas tres cosas que me llaman la atención. En primer lugar, hay muchas afirmaciones... Hay muchas afirmaciones que no tienen una referencia bibliográfica. Quiere decir cosas que, no es que yo vaya a corroborarlo, pero estudiosos del futuro querrán ver el documento en el cual ustedes se han basado para hacer esa afirmación y no está en el libro. Esa es una. Otra es... Uno ve la descripción de Mao de ustedes, es él es perezoso, es no es un hombre valiente, es cobarde, es todo es mal. Y sin embargo, uno ve que a la vez, continuamente, él está subiendo en el partido alguna. Es decir, me pregunto, ¿no será que ustedes están demasiado cerca del personaje y no son lo suficientemente, no tienen la distancia del personaje? Eso.
Thank you. So, well, the two questions, John, you take the first one in terms of the sourcing of some of the information.
What are they? The three things without...
The question's coming back to you.
What are the things that without bibliography?
No. Por ejemplo, se afirma... De las afirmaciones... Como han hecho ustedes hoy acá, claro que no pueden dar la fuente, pero me parece que en el libro hay mucho de eso. Se hacen afirmaciones, pero uno no puede...
Can you be specific yet?
No, por ejemplo, para venir a una cosa aquí, Mao lo cargaban y él se mandó a hacer incluso la litera. ¿Está eso referenciado? ¿Está en alguna parte el documento que... A mí me parece que en el libro no está, a menos que no esté en español. En la versión español.
Okay, let's deal with. Oh, right,
yes,
let's
yes,
deal with that point specifically, because otherwise it's a vague.
That one has many we learned this from many people, but in the book I think we cited at least two sources. One was from a friend of Mao's, a wife of Mao's colleague, who wrote in her memoir, she had this conversation with Mao just before the Long March, and Mao showed off to her the bed, the litter with which he was going to be carried. And it was in the memoir of this lady called Liu Ying. It's in our book. And the other source was, Mao saying to his colleague, to his staff member, in fact, the head of his secretariat, somebody called the Ye Zilong, who said that Mao had said to him, on the Long March, I had nothing to read. I was in the bed. I was being carried in the litter. I had nothing to do. I was lying in the litter. Being carried, what did I do? I read a lot. I mean, so we had at least these two sources.
Okay. And on the second, your second question, I mean, there's nothing inconsistent between saying Mao was lazy or a coward. I mean, actually, for example, we didn't say that, but even, for example, Hitler was lazy. It didn't stop him rising to the top and being an extremely effective dictator. And I think Mussolini was a coward. It didn't stop him getting into power and being a dictator, not so effective, for over 20 years. So there's nothing inconsistent between having these personal characteristics and yet rising to power. And the second point is, you know, the question of whether you're too close. Well, what do you want us to do? You know, to wait another 20 years till our witnesses are dead, or I'm dead, you know, and then I can't write the book. I mean, and also, I don't see why it doesn't make any sense to say you're getting too. You've got to get close enough to know as much as you possibly can about your subject, and then, of course, you must be fair. And you must be, as it's called, objective. But the fact is, just to take, Hitler had some appalling personal characteristics, as well as horrible political practices and genocide and so on. And he spent a lot of time loafing around. But the fact is, he was uncontested, virtually uncontested leader of what was in some ways a very effective dictatorship. Okay, so,
thank you.
Yeah.
We'll move on to another question now.
En su opinión, ¿cómo conviven este Partido Comunista con unas ideas claramente basadas en los fundamentos de Mao con la China actual un poco progresista y con este gran desarrollo avanzada? ¿Cómo pueden combinar estas dos formas de pensar en un solo momento?
Thank you. Lovely to have a short question,
well,
too.
Yes,
you.
I mean, in today's China is almost completely different. I mean, it's very, very different from Mao's China. China changed after Mao died. I mean, hugely different thing, was people are now able to travel. You know, Mao died in 76, and I was able to leave China in 1978. I was able to sit for a national exam, which had been abolished by Mao, and I did reasonably well, so I was able to get to England for studies. I mean, millions of people are enjoying this now. And all these changes, the China we see with high rises and, you know, people having a very much better life. All these have been achieved after Mao died and because he had died.
A hand there. Okay, all right, is there someone there? Sorry, there's so many hands. Well, whoever's got the microphone, go for it.
I'm exchange student from China, and now I'm studying in Tecnológica de Bolívar.
English.
I want to say something. As a student, firstly, respect for doctor and for your conversation. But I want to say something is that in that time, after 1949, just that in that time in China, that situation is very terrible. The ex-president take a lot of money and go to Taiwan. And after the war, my country is a disaster. So Mao is not want to conquer something. He just need to, as a leader, in a way that to see the world. So he need to make some sacrifice
I'm sorry, are you coming to a question here?
And to make decisions. Because at that time it's really, really terrible. So we need industry. We need some things to protect ourselves. And secondly, the security of Mao is very, very important.
Sorry, can you bring this to a question? Because also we need to we've come to the end of the hour.
I can address.
Can you address that?
You're saying that Mao took power. I mean, he. The question is whether Mao made China a better place compared to the regime before. He didn't. I mean, under Mao, in 4 years, between 1958 and 1961, 38 million people died of starvation. And this was unprecedented in Chinese history or in the history of the world. I mean, in the year Mao died, in 1976, the average food intake in China was lower than in the 1930s. Before Mao took power. And all this is in the official record. Mao didn't make China stronger. And actually, it's in our book, even his military, expensively purchased the military the bombs and so on, was in shambles. He didn't give the Chinese a better life. He was a disaster. He pulled China back. For decades, I mean, without Mao, the Chinese would have had a much better life, a much freer life, decades ago.
Can I just add
two thoughts to that, and then we have to finish.
Yes, the point you're making is one, it's a very common delusion, and it's actually completely false. In the period that Mao was in power in China, China's percentage of world GDP, I mean, world production fell from over 4% to about 2.6%. China went way down in the scales of its economic output as a percentage of world economic output. And that includes domestic consumption. The other thing is in 1971, I don't know if you know this, but the statistics released after Mao died show that per capita income in China, after Mao had been in power for 20 years, was lower than it was in Somalia, which is one of the very poorest countries in Africa. And that's what Mao did for China. And those are the statistics, and they are unassailable.
Well, and on that note, the book is available out of the back there or at the front, and Jung will be and John will be signing copies. And I'd like you all to thank them very, very much for coming and sharing what's been quite riveting for me.
Thank you.